Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Award-winning sports writer Steve Rushen has written about thousands of interesting people, events, and games in his career, from ice golfers in the Arctic to the demise of the ballpark near his boyhood home.
But for people with Milwaukee ties, some of his most memorable words came when he delivered the commencement address at his college alma mater, Marquette University, in 2007. Rushen had a regular column in Sports Illustrated for years.
His work does not appear in the iconic magazine nearly as frequently anymore, but he has reached as many fans with an active Twitter feed, a podcast he co-hosts with his wife, Rebecca Lobo, and a recent memoir of his Minnesota boyhood called Stingray Afternoons. He was back at Marquette recently to talk with journalism students there and visited us as well. Welcome. Always nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So you have covered umpteen thousands of individual sporting events in far corners of the world. I gather at this stage of your career, it's kind of a more selective phase of what you do, what you write, what you cover.
It is. I mean, it's more selective from me, and it's more selective from them. At Sports Illustrated, we have half as many issues as we used to have. It's become a biweekly. It's, you know, that's what the industry is doing. And so they're picking their spots. I'm picking my spots. I'm enjoying writing books in addition to writing, I wrote 800-word columns for 10 years. 80,000-word books are a nice change of pace from that as well. But, yeah, I still love to cover sports. And when I'm not covering them, I'm watching them on TV and not getting paid for it. Imagine that.
Also, umpteen, a good high school clinic for future baseball officials, I
think. Umpteen, I like that. Yeah, that's really good.
Like we can get a whole chain of them around the country.
All of my kids' games, I've got four young kids all in Little League sports, and all of their referees and umps are teens. And it can be a bit frustrating when you get the shy teen who doesn't want to call attention to himself by blowing the whistle. We get that a lot, and it makes the basketball games go faster, but they're not really reffed as well as you'd like.
Have you ever, do you ever play roles in your children's sports?
Yes, absolutely. My wife coaches all of our kids in basketball, but I have.
As you would hope.
As you would hope. And I've become the guy who runs the clock. And when I'm running the clock, I treat that board as if it's mission control at NASA. There's only two buttons that I really have to remember. And yet, in almost every game this season, I've inadvertently blown the horn 15 seconds into the game. You got to watch that shot clock. Somebody sets the shot clock from the previous game and our kids aren't using a shot clock. The shot clock will go off in those first 30 seconds. And it's embarrassing, you know? You get shamed by the ref. The ref's 12. And and the game has to stop and restart.
Well, and you have no control over the attitude the other parents bring to the games.
I tell you, I could talk to you forever about other parents, and I deal with my kids' games by internalizing everything. We talk about it on the ride home. I'm talking about decisions by the referee or whatever happened. There are parents who don't have that filter, and it can get pretty stressful at these games. I've heard from swim parents. I've heard from hockey parents. My experience is mostly in basketball, but I've been in a gym in the last 5 weeks where three adults have been thrown out of the gym in the last 5 weeks, so it's a little kooky out there.
I know this is you and your wife produce a podcast, and this is kind of something that came up in the last episode of the podcast. There's a conversation about the fact that there are many of us as adults who choose not to exercise the filter muscle when they go to a sports event.
You know, it always amazes me when I see parents yelling at the refs. It's, you know, that was a travel. That was a foul. If they're being truly objective, wouldn't they also be yelling that about their own players and their own kids? Hey, my kid just traveled. You didn't call it. Hey, my kid just fouled that kid. You never hear that. And we were at a high school basketball game recently where it was very, very clearly delineated that the visiting fans sit over here, the home fans sit on this side. And a fan from the other side, middle-aged guy, just decided to sit in the middle of the other team's fans, which is fine. You know, this isn't 1980s English soccer where it's going to go off hooligan style. But it seemed his whole purpose was to agitate and troll the home fans, which is fine. I just don't know what the motivation of a 45-year-old guy, you know, at a high school girls' basketball game would be to do that. But, hey, whatever floats your boat. We want our kids to care about, you know, winning and losing. It can be important. It usually isn't, but they have that built in anyway. They want to win. But they don't care about it nearly as much as many of the parents and many of the coaches. You know, they're happy to go into the parking lot, listen to their music, go home, and do whatever after. Whereas you can see that some of these parents are carrying it with them for many hours afterwards, and it's crazy. You know, who cares is my opinion. And if I could carry one big bedsheet spray-painted banner at these games, it would be, who cares? This is something for them to do, get exercise, get out of the house, get them off of, you know, whatever they were binge-watching. This is not a means to a college scholarship or a professional career. It's something to do on Saturday afternoon.
What kind of sports fans are you raising your kids as?
Well, my son loves the NBA and he loves Major League Baseball, but he's more into those. He experiences those more through like the Xbox or baseball cards or not through sitting through a nine-inning Major League game. And, you know, I live in New England, and to take him to a Red Sox game or a Yankees game requires a small business loan and a week of planning because these games are generally sold out, at least at Fenway. And, you know, nine innings is just it's 4 hours to sit through, and they're just not into that. And I kind of makes me wonder who the people are going to be going to games 30 years from now, because they're certainly not raising young people to be fans of these things, televising the World Series at midnight and all that. And, you know, all these television figures are skewing so much older, even for the NBA, which is the young, hip league. You know, I think the average age is in their 40s for their average viewer. But they love to turn anything into a competition. Who gets in and out of the car first? Who, you know, gets the last roll on the dinner table and all that stuff. So we had a little dunk hoop, a little Nerf hoop in my son's room, and he wasn't using as much as we thought he would. We put it on the front door in our front hall, and now every day he comes down, and before school he's dunking on that and shooting hoops. And through a long winter, we're playing a lot of sports, hallway soccer, hamper hoop basketball, that kind of stuff. So sports is a daily part of their lives and our lives. But as a sports fan, it's not what I was as a kid. It's not watching the games on TV or attending the games so much. You know, when I was a kid, you could go to a Twins game for $5. Now it's, you know, they could go to a Red Sox game for $150. It's just not the same.
I was just reading a book by one of your former colleagues, George Dorman, on the nature of obsessive sports fans. And one of the takeaways he got from his research was the realization that when you have very young kids around, seeing their dad or their mom flip out about their team doing poorly raises them to look at everything in black and white, as young kids do. And the upshot for him is he's taken some of his sports fandom out of the house until they get older. And it got me thinking about, you know, watching my mom flip out over the Celtics growing up. It sounds like for you, your kids are kind of growing up to be these sort of, I don't know, Renaissance sports fan. Well, doesn't seem the right word, but fans of everything.
They're more sort of ecumenical in their sports fandom. They're not necessarily fans of the local team. I mean, my son likes the Red Sox. He likes the New York Giants. A lot of kids in his class like those teams. But he becomes completely invested in whoever is playing if he chooses a team. I tell you, the one game that he watches probably more than any other because it's on at a time that we can watch it is English Premier League soccer on Saturday mornings. And he'll say, you know, Dad, who are we cheering for? Are we cheering for Man City? Or are we cheering for West Brom? I said, well, we're cheering for West Brom because Man City's, you know, the Goliath. So he will then become completely invested in that. Same thing with the Minnesota Vikings. I grew up in Minnesota when the Vikings were making their playoff run. He really couldn't have cared less about the Vikings 3 weeks earlier, but those Vikings playoff games, he became completely living and dying, a bad mood if you know they lost. And I was like that as a kid. And so I don't want to pretend that my son in particular, he gets upset if the guy he's never heard of loses the U.S. Open tennis match against the other guy he's never heard of because he has chosen that guy early on. And I kind of like that. I was that way as well. And you mentioned your mom and the Celtics. You know, when I was in high school and the Celtics, those great Celtics teams of the 80s, that was the team I loved more than any other team in my life. And it was partly to do with the age, partly to do with that Celtics-Lakers rivalry. And I remember after the Celtics lost the game to the Pistons, getting in my mom's car, a Honda Accord, I had to drive on an errand somewhere, and I, not looking, I cut somebody off, and the guy gave me a honk of warning. And I remember being so angry that I laid on the horn in front of the guy now. I'd already cut him off. I'm now in front of him, and I'm laying on the horn, you know, angrily shaking my fist with a raised finger behind me, It was crazy, you know. But that was probably I was probably 17, and
Danny Ainge had just missed a 3-pointer.
Exactly, and it affected my life. And a beautiful thing about becoming a sports writer, it doesn't take away your passion or your interest or even your rooting interest.
So you write about your Minnesota childhood in your latest book, and we get this glimpse into what attracted you to sports. But the other thing that really jumps out at me is the things about sports that also attracted you to wordplay. You, as much as anyone, have kind of captured the Venn diagram, the overlap between sports and words.
Well, you know, I loved that as a kid. And, you know, I remember I write in the book seeing, you know, the word win concealed in twins. And the twins would always have, you know, win twins stickers and that. And I just loved that, you know, those two words. They certainly weren't synonymous in any other way in the 70s because the twins were never winning. Al Oliver wore the number zero on the back of a shirt, you know, for Oliver. And I just thought those things I loved. Jim Otto, the Oakland Raiders center, had a palindrome on his back and the number 00. And those things just stuck with me. And, you know, I grew up in the 70s. The Vikings were losing 4 Super Bowls during that time. I was, you know, kind of raised in a very sports-crazy house with 4 boys and a girl. And I just remember, you know, Vietnam was constantly in the news. And sometimes it was spelled Vietnam with one word. Sometimes it was 2 words, Viet space Nam. And I remember thinking as a kid, there was something about uniting, you know, North and South Vietnam. Was they trying to unite these 2 words? You know, was the country split typographically, you know, in the middle? And so I've always associated words with sports and been kind of a baseball card collector as a kid who you know, obsessed over the names and love all that stuff. It's just, you know, they're like alphabet blocks that you can build with and make stuff out of.
Like seeing the former ballplayer Darryl Boston coaching first base for the Chicago White Sox and seeing Boston on his back and Chicago on his front.
Love it, exactly. Seeing, you know, Charles Hudson, the former pitcher, you know, the river in Boston and the river in New York, and, you know, the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry. How great is that? I remember reading, I think it was in a Roger Angel, one of his baseball books that I was reading as a kid, at the time, Aurelio Rodriguez was the only major leaguer with all 5 vowels in his first name. And Ed Figueroa had all 5 vowels in his last name. And I would stare at that fact for minutes. You know, it blew my mind. And unfortunately, it never left my mind. And I still remember these things and don't remember important things like what kind of milk my kids drink.
Did you have a baseball encyclopedia growing up?
I did, yeah. I you know, this was at a time when People, I mean, would think that's ridiculous now, but it was, 2,000 pages, weighed, I don't know, 40 pounds, and it cost a small fortune, but I saved up for it. And my grandfather played one game for the 1926 New York Giants, and he was in the baseball encyclopedia. And so you could open this tome and, you know, blow dust off the pages and see there's Jimmy Boyle, my grandpa, in the baseball encyclopedia. And to this day, fewer than 20,000 people, you know, have played Major League Baseball since 1869. I mean, you put 20,000 people in, it wouldn't fill the United Center. You know, it's the population of a small town. And imagine one small town where everybody there played Major League Baseball. I do imagine that. So you don't have to, because I've done that for you. And that's the contents of the baseball encyclopedia. It's like the phone book for this small town of Major League Baseball players.
You mentioned your son collects baseball cards. I don't know about your daughters. But that too, seems to be a pastime that's like having a typewriter on your desk these days.
It's a pastime that has passed time. Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, partly because they, you know, flooded the market with cards in the 80s, and partly because, you know, there's other stuff to do. I get that. I'm not one of these people who thinks everything was better then. I mean, most stuff is better now. It doesn't seem like that on a daily basis sometimes. But yeah, when I was a kid, you could go for a quarter and get a Tops pack of Tops at Pickwick, our local candy store, and you know, get the pink rectangle of gum that was pressed from the same cardboard that the cards were pressed from. And then sometimes you'd get a really good player on top, but the piece of gum would be stuck to it, so it'd have that residue, and you'd have to scratch it off with your thumbnail. But that is such a, you know, a Proustian memory of the smell of the gum, the smell of the cards. Yes, to answer your next question, yes, I was smelling the cards. I was sniffing the baseball cards in the same way as if you would get a fresh pair of basketball shoes. You'd place the sneaker over your nose and mouth and breathe normally as you would on an airplane oxygen mask. But you know, my kids, if I was growing up playing Mattel in television baseball, where you know you'd hit a little 8-bit ball off, boing, it bounce off the wall, we'd love that, and there'd be a crowd roar. Now my son can play. I mean, realistic looking, he's manipulating LeBron James in NBA basketball. I get it. I understand why that's attractive to them more so than baseball cards. But he does still like to flip through his baseball cards with a flashlight in bed at night, and so I love that too.
What do you get out of podcasting with your wife?
Well, the main thing I get is 45 minutes of conversation with my wife. So I'm in Milwaukee now. I live in Hartford. Yesterday, she broadcasts basketball games for ESPN. So she had been in Eugene, Oregon for the previous couple of days. Yesterday she got home to our garage. I took her bag out of the shotgun seat, put my bag in, and went back to the airport, took the car back to the airport. So the 45 minutes of conversation with my wife, I mean, it sounds like a joke, but honestly, we wouldn't be sitting down for those 45 minutes to talk anyway. And most of what we talk about is stuff that we haven't previously talked about. And, I've been in print journalism my whole life. So I'm one of those guys who, for good reason, you may be familiar with my writing or my print voice, but you've never heard me speak. This is why, because I can't speak. I don't know what I look like. And so it's just another way of talking to people that doesn't require me to sit down and spend 8 hours alone in a room. I can kind of, have my unfiltered thoughts. When you hear my unfiltered thoughts, you know why they require 8 hours in a room to make coherent. But it's just fun for me. There's no ulterior motive. We're not trying to sell anything. We're not selling advertising. We're not it's a money loser because you have to buy a microphone. But so it's just purely for fun. And if it's ever not fun, we just won't do it.
Well, and it dawns on me that maybe there are marriage counselors around the world who ought to be suggesting that their clients sit down and record a podcast together.
In fact, the first week we did it, one of our neighbors who had listened, and we had no idea if anybody was going to listen, and people did. One of our neighbors said to me, was that podcast, was it court-ordered? And I said, no, it wasn't a court-ordered podcast, but that would have been a good alternative name for it. It's called Ball and Chain, but court-ordered, the court-ordered podcast might have been better.
If nothing else, it would be a good band name.
Exactly, like OAR, I think we were talking about earlier.
Well, Steve Rushen, it is always well worth it to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us and talking sports and life.
Oh, my pleasure.
Sports writer and Marquette grad Steve Rushen's latest book is a memoir called Stingray Afternoons. He hosts a podcast with his wife, ESPN analyst and former basketball player Rebecca Lobo. It's called The Ball and Chain Podcast. We spoke with him while he was back in Milwaukee to talk with journalism students at Marquette.